some of this, but the speed that we left Earth and the speed that we, once we reached the moon, at what speed was the spacecraft moving when it approached the moon?
See, now, Greg told me I wouldn't have to answer those kinds of questions.
I told him I wouldn't ask him any math questions.
But I think, that if I recall correctly, and I don't remember, but it was the reentry speed, at least as you initially hit the atmosphere, was, I think, something like 27,000 miles an hour or something, some ridiculous number like that. Very fast.
Yeah. The Apollo 11 documentary that's out now has a great, footage of all this, but they have some great little kind of animations that show speed and velocity and descent and things like that, too. So I recommend that as well.
The Apollo 11 documentary, if you haven't had a chance to see that, I think that was done with CNN, but the one that we got to see initially was the same version, except a little extended, done in IMAX, and it was tremendous to see it. I know Dave Corbin got to see a bunch of these Saturn V launches. I only got to see one in Apollo 15, and frankly, it is an earth-shaking, wondrous event to see one of those big rockets lift off. And in IMAX, they do the sound, you feel almost the vibration because I got the bass way down and it vibrates the room.
In a few years, they'll have the G-force and everything.
Exactly.
Probably.
Same. Yeah.
Here's another question.
Spencer, when did you leave the program?
I left NASA in 1974, right after I graduated from law school. I'd gone to law school at night the last few years. I left the Apollo program and went to work in a program at NASA called the Modular Integrated Utility Systems, which was an effort to try to take space technology and apply it to earthbound issues and problems in conjunction with HUD. And I did that for the last couple of years I was at NASA before I left.
Just a comment on the Saturn booster. I grew up in Orlando, and we used to go out on our front porch and watch the Mercury and Gemini flights. And we also had a place on the St. Johns River, which is about 30 miles from the launch pad. And when I saw my first Saturn V rocket go off, we were standing on the banks of the St. Johns River, 30 miles away, and the ground is shaking, and you can hear it. That's how powerful it is.
It was just, and it was an amazing experience to watch one of those launches.
I have a comment and a question. First of all, I've known you, Spencer, for 26 years, and I never knew this about you. So it makes me kind of rethink my connections. Maybe I need to get to know people better. Second is, I was always haunted by that. The fire where the three astronauts were killed, were you working on that day?
No, I was still at Georgia Tech. I didn't graduate till March. That happened in January of 67. I graduated in March, and it was one of the reasons I was where I was when I was that fire. If that fire hadn't happened, I probably would have been somewhere else and not involved in all of this stuff. That occurred January 67, and we flew Apollo 7 in 68. So we didn't wait around long.
And how did that inspire people? Did you feel that shadow over the program while you were doing these, moving into 68 and 69?
Oh, it sort of turned topsy-turvy a lot of things. When I came to work, it was every piece of whatever that was inside the spacecraft was being evaluated for its flammability, which was not an issue that necessarily had been so prominent, if you will, before then. And books were made with we wound up using paper, but, boy, there was an effort to take books and try to print it on non-flammable material. And was a big effort.
Yeah.
Consumed everybody, I think, out there.
So I watched a movie about the Apollo 11, and the thing that I didn't know was that when they took off again to go back home, the driver, was it Collins?
Collins.
He asked one of the other astronauts, hey, would you like to drive this thing? And the other astronaut said, well, Mission Control wouldn't like that. And then he said, well, we're on the dark side of the moon. They're not going to know about it. So I'm just wondering if that's really true.
I don't know.
One of the other things that I thought was really remarkable was how quickly the amount of time between the first flight of the Wright brothers and flying to the moon is what, 60 years?
1903 to 1969.
Yeah, which is remarkable, and the fact that I heard Jim Lovell was the one that had that escorted Charles Lindbergh to the launch, and just to think of the time frame is just remarkable.
How old would you estimate the staff at NASA to be at the time of Apollo 11? Quite young.
Well, it depended on which level. I mean, the operational people at the level that I was, we were mostly fairly young. There were a lot of 20-year-olds, 20-somethings, between 25 and 30. There were people, because they had to staff it up. And if you stop and think, NASA was formed in the 50s, I guess it was, and it was a small group of folks at Langley that turned into the Space Task Group that were brought into, this was in the 60s, brought eventually to Houston, and that was a small group, and all those people were added to it, and a lot of those folks were recent graduates from small engineering schools that, frankly, the government didn't pay very much. So if you went to work for the government, you were going to take less pay than if you went to work for somebody else. And so they were getting engineers from a lot of schools all over the place. And I think it was because we were young and wanted a job, and some of us loved being in the space business. I mean, I had a connection with NASA, and so I knew what I was getting into when I came back, regardless of what the pay was. But, you know, some folks were just happy to have a job.
And I've heard it was also just that you're doing something completely new, that in a sense, the experience that maybe older people had may not have been quite as valuable as just someone that had a new way of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, David?
Is it true that we have more computing power in our smartphones than was used in all the computers flying to the moon?
Yes, sir.
It is true.
Spence, did you ever get to meet Wernher von Braun?
I think I did. And the reason I say that, because they ran, if you remember a while ago, I described the various tiers in the control center. And right behind us was the Big Cheese's mission operations director, and the NASA administrator would come sit back there sometimes doing the missions, and some of those people would come back there, and occasionally I'd meet a number of those people just because of the proximity. And I think he was one of the ones that came at some point. I have a vague recollection of that, but I am not really sure whether that's an accurate recollection or not. Yes, he was huntful in dealing with the rocket, but he did come over to JSC or MSC at the time.
Spencer, what experience or involvement did you have in Apollo 13, if any, the one that messed up?
Uh, I was working that mission just like I worked on Apollo 12 and had a shift. I had gone off shift probably a couple hours before the oxygen tank exploded, and I was at home. I heard that there was an issue with Apollo 13, and I called my console to ask the guy that was on duty. I said, what's going on? He says, well, I think looks like we might not be able to land. We just might have to do a flyby or something. We got a little issue that's going to cut this short. And I said, and he said, you better get some sleep because you're going to have a busy day replanning all this stuff tomorrow. So I went to bed, and about 15 minutes after I was in bed, I got a call from the guy on the console that says, Gene Kranz says, get your butt in here. So from that time on, I was essentially involved in all the issues related to planning those activities and doing whatever was necessary in that group, reschedule the procedures and did all that business.
And what was the mood while you were working that and working those just lots and lots of problems and looking for solutions? What was the mood or the feel of mission control during those few days?
Do whatever it takes. You work the problem. I mean, it was. We're not going to lose this crew. We're going to get this crew back, one way or the other.
Oh, I don't have a question. I have a comment. It's beyond my comprehension how there are people that still don't believe it happened. I think they're the same group that don't think the Holocaust happened, but.
Spencer, was there any benefit to having the Johnson Space Center in Texas and the launch site in Florida, or was that more of a political prize for the senators of those states?
Well, the benefit for me was that I got to come here and meet Linda. Otherwise, I would not have been here. I don't know, because I came into it as a graduate, and those decisions had already been made. There was something to be said about separating the control center from the Cape and not having it all in one place. The location probably would not have made any difference other than you didn't want to concentrate all of that.
At the same place.
Although Mercury Control and the first couple of the Gemini flights were controlled out of a mission control at the Cape. But it was sort of put off to the side. They had a room that was off to the side. It was not treated as primary. And here it was central and primary. So that probably helped in the training and the structure and all that was required to do mission control.
So one quick question. Do you still have your slide rule, and do you know how to use it?
You slide the little thing out, you add up the two numbers? No. Yes, I still have it.
So, Spencer, you mentioned there was a critical phase where there was like 60 seconds of fuel left, 30 seconds of fuel, and I gathered that that could have all turned bad. So can you paint sort of a picture of what would have happened if everything had been a minute off, or what would the abort look like? If they hadn't been able to land, would they be able to just take off again?
Well, landing and then taking off again, we were set up to do that. I mean, that was the plan, in the sense that you went through a process to be prepared to take off once you landed. You didn't know whether, as I said earlier, you didn't know whether you shook something loose, you were tilted, or what might happen. And so you set the procedures up so that you landed with the idea that you might have to take off right then. As to landing, once Neil got to within the distance he did at 30 seconds, he was going to land that thing, because the option just physically lighting the ascent engine, waiting for it to start, or even throttling up the descent engine, you might not have been able to stop the descent enough before you could get back into to orbit. Pardon me. So I at a certain level, if you hadn't aborted earlier, you were going to have to put the thing down at some particular place. You just might not like the place, and you hopefully would be able to abort if you're not descending so fast that you wouldn't have time to at least start the engine, have it come up to speed, and have you take off, because it would take a few seconds in there for that process to happen. You wouldn't want to crash in those few seconds. So down at 30 seconds, he was going to land, I think.
Spencer, sorry. I watched the PBS footage of all the goings-on from the get-go. I found it very interesting, the number of things that were actually created by the space station. I mean, they said that the computer on the space capsule didn't have as much power as our standard cell phones do these days. But they talked about all the items that have come about for us to make our life better that were created because of the space program. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, I like to think of it as in paying for things like space program or an equity investment, long-term investment, because much of what we did there manifested itself in subsequent things that you have now. Some of the fabrics that were designed, some of the solar protections that were designed, some of the engine, some of the electronics that were designed for the purposes of using solar power and distributing and using solar power as you get to the space station and Skylab and the space station and some of those things came out of that. The miniaturization of the computer, we had to miniaturize the computer for Apollo. The computer may not have had much power, but for the time it had a lot of power for the size. And the effort to make that smaller led to a lot of the stuff that we have now being smaller and portable and carryable around. There are a number of websites that go into the details of what were the benefits. I can't recall them all, but those are the ones that I can recall right now.
Could you talk a little bit about the test pilots, the fact that they use test pilots to be astronauts, and maybe just a little bit about Neil Armstrong?
Well, one of the things, the reasons they used test pilots is because it was a risky program initially, and they wanted to make sure that they had people that had dealt with that kind of risk. Test pilots are trained to fly beyond the envelope, as they like to say, to test things at the edge and to be able to report it back, hopefully calmly, no matter what, and are willing to take those risks. So there's a certain attitude, a certain personality type, and a training that goes along with having a test pilot. As you got later in the astronaut selection, they dropped the test pilot requirement, but that was for the early part of the program. It was a risky business. When you go into space, you got to be prepared to lose some people. I mean, it just happens. And just like flying airplanes in 1903, 1904, 1905, you got to be prepared for people to die and run that risk. It's got to be an acceptable risk. The problem is sometimes I don't think we're willing to accept those kinds of risks anymore. But that's why you have a test pilot. Neil was a consummate professional. I worked more with Mike Collins on that mission and Buzz Aldrin than I did with Neil. And so I didn't get to know him as well as I did Mike. Mike Collins was is a very funny and easy to work with kind of guy. Neil was all was generally all business, but he was. I haven't seen First Man, and I've heard some discussion about it. I've heard some reviews that he comes across rather stiff and wooden in the movie, but he wasn't that way in my dealings with him. He was a pleasure to work with, but he was business. You were not going to mess around with him.
What was your major? And did your major or your other qualities of you when you were a co-op student working there that land you that job?
My major was, I have an aerospace, Bachelor of Aerospace Engineering. It was my major. And I don't know what landed me. I asked my boss through all this time period, his name's Tommy Holloway. He was at the reunion. I asked him, why did you ever hire me for this? Why did you put me in this? I don't understand. Because I listened to some of the links. There's a website, apolloinrealtime.org, that plays all the air-to-ground and all of the loops that they were able to record. They missed some of the loops a little bit, and had to find my loop. But I found it, and I listened to myself. I don't know why they hired me. I don't know that they hired me back then either.
If we want to learn more about the Apollo program or interested in this, are there any particular books or movies or documentaries that you'd recommend especially?
Yes, there is the Apollo 11 documentary movie that I mentioned earlier. There's a book called Apollo, and there are several books by that name, but it was written back in the 80s, I believe. And I have an autographed copy from the authors, and I should remember the author's name. There are two authors, and I cannot remember their names right now off the top of my head. But it is one of the better books for reading the details if you want to get down into the nitty-gritty. Reading Gene Kranz's book, Failure is Not an Option, is a good discussion of mission control and how flight control sort of works. That's a good book to read.
I think you were telling me a book about the decision of whether to go to the moon with a single rocket or staged. Was that?
Yeah, that was in that Apollo, and I wish I could remember the name of the authors.
But that's the one that's really good.
Yeah, and it's a good discussion of the decision of whether to do direct, which would take you directly from the Earth to the moon in one big, huge craft, or do an Earth orbit type of situation and then take a craft out of Earth orbit directly to the land on the moon, or the idea that Mr. Holbert, H-O-U-L-B-O-L-T, I think his name was.
Kind of a lonely voice.
Well, it was initially, he wasn't the only one, but it was initially a lonely voice, and gradually people came to see that as what appears now to be the more obvious way of doing it, and having a spacecraft that you don't have to worry about aerodynamics, don't have to worry about all the other reentry and all that other stuff, and having it carried into lunar orbit.
Do you have a sense of what the future of the space program is? Or perhaps what you would like it to be?
Oh, what I'd like it to be is I wish we were on Mars by now, but that's another. Show me the money.
Yeah.
I mean, until their money is appropriated for it and NASA's allowed to go do something, have a plan that they can pursue long term. It is not a short term and it a thing that gets changed hither and yon and be given some direction to go off and do something. Like, my own personal opinion is that they ought to go to the moon for the purposes of at least learning how to live on a different body for an extended period of time before you take the next step to Mars. But you could do that in fairly quick succession if you're willing to spend the money.
Yeah. What about private efforts?
Hope they work.
Yeah.
That's fine with me.
Yeah, but a lot going on as
yes.
far as that goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Damon. Curious Damon.
How in the world did you go from the space program to law?
Why does anybody go from law to preaching? I mean, it was. Somebody asked me earlier, and I said it. Richard Dixon. He cut Apollos 18, 19, and 20. And I'm 26, 27 years old looking at, I'm flying missions, and he's cutting missions. What am I going to do? So I took a graduate engineering course and made a C in it. And I said, that ain't it. And so I then looked around for something else, and lo and behold, I got accepted into law school, and that's what I went and did. I could do that at night. While still working at NASA. That's...
Taking risk, single points of failure. The ascent. Was there only one rocket engine available for the ascent? And if so, were there any EVAs or other things in the plans to try to do a workaround had the rocket not fired up when it was supposed to?
The ascent engine was a essentially a combustion chamber with a single bell. Everything else was duplicated. The fuels, when they came together, they ignited, so you didn't have to have an ignition source. And the only thing you had to do is make sure that they came together in that engine belt. And we had multiple valves, multiple pumps, and multiple tanks to be able to do that. The only single point was the bell itself, and if you crack that thing, then you might have a problem, but you would have a problem if you had two engines, and you who knows, you might crack it. It's like flying a twin. You got twice the things that could go wrong in a single engine airplane, right? So you don't know. No, there was no, that was a single point, if you will. The service propulsion system going into and getting out of lunar orbit was also an engine that could, if that did not work coming out, it could be a potential problem. But there were all the backups that you could have, and you minimized the things that could go wrong with that one single point there.
Like for you to ask him the question that you've always begun every interview with about their growing up years. Because I remember, I think, that Spencer's father was a Baptist minister.
Yeah, tell us. I usually ask, just tell us a little bit about growing up and your parents and your family and kind of how they set you on the path that you ended up going.
It's interesting you ask that question because one of my brothers just did a bunch of stuff, some of which I knew about our history, and I've had Baptist preachers in my family since the 1700s. My grandfather was a Baptist preacher. My father was a Baptist preacher. My sister's married to a Baptist preacher. I have a brother that's an ordained minister, although he's not preaching now. I have another brother that's a music minister. And I just didn't quit along with any of that stuff, so I went off and became a lawyer. No. I grew up like a lot of other people, and looking at what you could do, and I happened to have at least a little bit of passing knowledge of math and science and decided to be an engineer. What better place to go than Georgia Tech in the middle of Atlanta? So that's what I did. Sometimes you look at it and it sort of just fell that way. It wasn't any pre-planned sort of thing.
Spencer, on this growing up thing, you grew up in Newberry.
No.
Are you were from Newberry?
No, my parents lived in Newberry when they died.
Oh, okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Simpsonville, South Carolina.
Why Georgia Tech and not Clemson or University of South Carolina? Because I grew up in Spartanburg, and that's the same question people ask me, is why Georgia Tech?
Well, do you want a real engineering school or you want a fake one? And so, yeah.
Very good. I like that answer. Mine was
I figured you would.
And did you plan on aerospace from the word go?
Yes. I was one of those that built model airplanes and had them hanging from the ceiling in the bedroom and all of that sort of thing from the time I was probably 12, 13. So, yes.
All right, Spencer, we've taken 2 hours of your time, which is more than I indicated that it would be. And so thank you very much for not only sharing your life with us, but answering questions. And we sure do appreciate you, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you.